When you coach an athlete that gets the call up to ride a grand tour, you can bet that I'll do everything I can to make sure that they are in the form of their life. So when there was space on the calendar for a training camp, we both went all in on an altitude training camp. It was a great learning experience, and I'm here to share the steps I took in planning and preparation and running the camp, and of course the takeaways and what I'll change next time. Yo, and welcome back to Ride Better, Faster, a show about cycling, training, and racing. I'm Damien Roos. Today, a practical look at training camps, but we also touch on why I chose to plan and execute an altitude training camp in the face of an active debate with valid arguments for and against them. We're also going to take a look at how a few of the World Tour teams structure their camps and how you could structure your own. I don't know how experienced you are with the altitude training lingo, but here's a quick refresher before we get going. When talking about altitude training, we talk about paradigms. And these paradigms are simply combinations of training and living at different altitudes. I've done two shows on altitude training that cover the progression of these paradigms. The last was in 2018, and nothing has really changed since then. But today is focused on one specific type of paradigm that was started in the late 90s, when in 1997, Ben Levine and James Stray Gunderson published a study that changed the way athletes were training, and a new family of live high, train low was born. Since then, various studies using the live high, train low paradigm have been conducted, and while most of the time the scientific debate has been around why there are improvements in endurance athletes rather than if there are improvements, there is an active debate on whether altitude training is beneficial at all. In the February 2020 edition of the Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise Journal, there are two special communications articles that sit on both sides of this debate. Aptly titled, "Hypoxic Training is Not Beneficial in Elite Athletes" and "Hypoxic Training is Beneficial in Elite Athletes," the arguments in these articles come down to the not beneficial side believing that the vast majority of altitude training studies are flawed because they're unblinded, subject to placebo effects, and sometimes with big differences in training load. While the beneficial side believe that even if the data is imperfect, it overwhelmingly points to a benefit from altitude training. Both sides have compelling arguments, but as a coach, I have to make a call on whether to do one or not. You might have guessed already that I chose to do one. Well, I was at least convinced enough to take a chance and undergo a training camp, which was my first as a coach. And I will say up front that this was meant as a learning experience for myself and the athlete, plus a test of the theory surrounding performance. Of course, knowing the impact that altitude can have on performance, at a minimum, we would be riding at similar elevations to the race and spending some focused time on and off the bike. As for the performance arguments, I went with a camp for two main reasons. First, the theory is sound. And second, lots of professional teams and riders swear by them, which may be controversial reasoning, but I'll explain my thoughts around this a little later on in the show. But before that, I want to take a hot second, a hot minute, to talk about the numbers. After reading everything I could on altitude training, I could see that the details are all about the numbers and getting them lined up. And this is where most of the work is, because performance after live high, train low altitude training is influenced by a wealth of confounding factors like the individual training plans, sickness, timing of performance after the camp, and individual responses. Also, right now, I'm not holding team training camps and do not need to ensure that the numbers line up for a group of athletes, so I can tune the variables and monitor the impact for an individual. And this allows me to reduce training errors, and in my book, that makes it more worthwhile. It's an investment in seeing what's possible with an athlete's unique makeup. The work of getting the numbers to line up starts weeks before the trek up the mountain. And it starts with the athlete doing a blood test to check iron levels. Based on a consensus statement of the International Olympic Committee, athletes should be checked for serum ferritin 8 to 10 weeks prior to altitude training or competition. And according to a 2018 paper, iron is necessary for optimal adaptation to altitude exposure. Therefore, iron status should be at a high level before attempting altitude training. It seems that once you're over a certain threshold, the number itself is less important than making sure that you normalize your iron stores before departure to altitude. And this is why checking up to 10 weeks out is important. And the most compelling evidence to do this comes from the Live High Train Low OGs, Stray Gunderson et al., who in 1992 demonstrated no increase in red cell mass or VO2 max in 9 iron deficient distance runners. After 4 weeks at 2,500 meters, while athletes with adequate ferritin levels pre-altitude demonstrated significant increases in red cell mass and VO2 max post-altitude camp. So if your iron status is low, you may need supplemental iron as long as iron deficiency is present. There are a good number of papers that you can reference to find common iron supplementation regimes. I'm not going to bother repeating them here, but I will link to them in the show's page. One thing I will note is several food products such as coffee, tea, dairy, and foods containing phytate can decrease iron absorption in the gut. And because of this, it's recommended to ingest iron supplements at least 1 hour before or at least 2 hours after meals or drinking coffee or tea. Also, in this pre-altitude blood test, it's a good time to get your total hemoglobin mass measured, because this is the thing that has the most evidence for its effect on performance from altitude training. With Levine and Stray Gunderson going all in on this and stating this is the only effect of altitude acclimatization that has directly and unequivocally been shown to improve sea level performance in athletes. In other words, there is no other effect of altitude acclimatization that can be or has been manipulated independently and demonstrated to improve athletic performance over a sustained period of time. This effect of altitude acclimatization is clear and compelling, particularly when the exposure is high enough and sustained for a long enough period of time. To dig in a little more, the theory here relies on two basic assumptions. Number one is spending enough time at altitude will trigger an increase in the amount of oxygen-carrying red blood cells in your body. And number two is increasing your red blood cell volume will enhance your endurance. Measuring the before, during, and after camp levels of your total hemoglobin mass is one way to monitor the impact of the time spent up high. It's important to note here that hemoglobin can be measured through blood samples either as the concentration of hemoglobin, which is what we did as we don't have access to other tests, but the gold standard and the measure that's used in all of the literature pretty much is the total amount of hemoglobin in the body. Finally, also note if you're ill, as indicated by levels of the inflammation marker C-reactive protein above 3 milligrams per liter, you must not train at altitude. You can't go to altitude sick and expect to improve. You're fighting to recover at full health, so there's no point in doing it with the added stress illness places on the body. Now that's basically it for the athletes' pre-altitude preparation. All that is left for them to do is to prepare mentally for a very challenging time. And I'll talk about what to expect regarding acclimatization in a moment, but the work here is really about setting up the athlete for success regardless of the inevitable setbacks. As I mentioned, one of the reasons I support altitude training is because lots of professional teams and riders swear by it. Now, that might seem like I'm blindly conforming to the way things have always been done in pro cycling, but honestly, and I'd say it's more my inexperience at this level, but I don't see any way around it mentally or physically to prepare for the acclimatization optimization for racing between 1500 and 2000 meters, except to spend time training at these altitudes, which includes staying at these altitudes, because without acclimatizing, your VO2 max can be around 10 to 13% lower, and your power can potentially be 4 to 6% lower before you factor in anything else. And with 2 weeks of acclimatization, this initial deficit can be reduced by about one half. So what are the World Tour teams doing? Well, I decided to do some Strava stalking, and I came up with five teams and at least one rider from each team that uploaded all of their data from a pre-tour Tour de France training camp. Well, there's no data from Ineos, but the teams are Jumbo-Visma, Israel Startup Nation, Bahrain Merida, and Alpecin Phoenix. And before the broad overview of what they did, it's important to talk about the timing of these camps, and when you do them can impact the potential increase in hemoglobin mass. Any increases are always in relation to baseline levels at the start of a camp. So if your baseline hemoglobin mass is already really high, then you're likely not to get any gains from the camp. Of course, this isn't the only reason to do a camp, which I've already kind of touched on, but this is your main reason. Timing has to be considered, and this really shouldn't be too hard with the athlete's quarterly blood tests. When we're talking pre-tour altitude camps, in a normal year, they're held in early to mid-May after some racing with some high mountaintop finishes done already pre-camp, and the camp is most likely done after a short break after the first peak or so of the season, so the athletes are building up again and the impact potential is high. Most teams will then do a preparation race before doing another short stint at altitude to either do stage recons or higher intensity training as part of their final prep for the tour. So let's break down these camps down to location, altitude, length, and paradigm. And starting with their altitude paradigm of choice, and all are doing live high, train low, except Jumbo-Visma. They go over 3,000 and 2,500 meters on three occasions in their training camp, while everyone does the bulk of their training under 2,000 meters. So strictly speaking, Jumbo-Visma is doing a mix of live high, train high, and live high, train low. Not to be confused with live high, train and low. Another topic for another day. Location-wise, we're talking Ineos in Tenerife. Same goes for Israel Startup Nation, which is no surprise as Chris Froome was on the camp. Then Jumbo-Visma goes all primo and stays at Sierra Nevada, which I'd say is the best equipped altitude training facilities in the world. Then Bahrain Merida are keeping it real by staying at a roadside hotel in Paz de la Casa, Andorra. And finally, Alpecin Phoenix land at a nice hotel in Belle Plange, France. The accommodation elevation ranges from 1947 meters to 2409 meters. And these are important numbers that are a big part of adequately performing the live high part of the live high train low paradigm. So what is the optimal altitude to live at during these camps? Well, Levine and Stray Gunderson asked the question about the optimal altitude back in 2006 and found that the data from their study suggested that there may be a relatively narrow window of optimal dose of altitude. They noted that the impact relies on spending at least 20 hours per day at altitude, interestingly, much more than the 12 hours or so recommended for altitude tents. But the optimal altitude recommended appears to be between 2,000 and 2,500 meters. And all teams hit this number, except Alpecin Phoenix, who, to be fair though, are only 53 meters off. But there really isn't one fixed altitude that is better than another. It's more important to monitor individual athletes for individual responses, and optimal levels will vary for different athletes. Plus, I found in my research on where to do these camps, finding the right place that is logistically possible and convenient can be really tricky. So monitoring is even more important, and we'll touch on that soon. Now let's talk about the length of the camps. They vary between 11 to 16 days, Ineos having the shortest and Jumbo-Visma and Bahrain Merida tying with the longest. And when it comes to the optimal exposure to altitude, the data is not so clear. It has been suggested that a minimum of 21 days at altitude are required for substantial increases in total hemoglobin mass, but further increases have been shown with 28 days of exposure. Conversely, a meta-analysis by Gore et al. In 2013 demonstrated a linear 1.1 increase in hemoglobin mass for every 100 hours of hypoxic exposure. Accordingly, it was suggested that athletes could expect hematological benefits following 2 weeks only of moderate altitude exposure. Moderate is between 2,000 and 3,000 meters. So if we're talking 14 days of minimal exposure, all the teams pass except for Ineos. And that's a curious one. The only thought I have around this is that I've read some of the team use altitude tents at home in preparation for camp, so at least the live high part can be reduced. Not sure what can explain the reduced camp length, But it all just could be down to practical reasons, and I imagine sometimes you just take what you can get. Now let's get into the nuts and bolts of training and the modifications to training at altitude. First up, I'll make it clear that there are no evidence-based guidelines regarding the best training program for an optimal live high, train low paradigm, and no evidence that supports the timing of the training. So while I did plan out the days, these were adjusted on a day-to-day basis, and these decisions are driven by daily monitoring and feedback, so this is where I look closely at pro teams to see what they're doing and how it matches my own ideas about how to roll out training for a camp. And this is a bit of a tangent, but the makeup of training from teams and other coaches really interests me, and I must admit that I spend a lot of time trying to work out the reasons behind types of training decisions made by coaches and teams at this level. And this is a bit random, but I recently read something that kind of explained back to me why I like doing this. And I read about this painting coach who tells students to copy their favorite artists, saying that at first students resist, but he responds by telling them to listen for friction. Do you hear that resistance? It's the whisper of your unique style. As a coach, training is my painting, and when I go through other people's plans, when I feel the resistance to what has been done, that's when I know I'm growing and finding my own ideas around training. But anyway, I have a framework for high-level training recommendations from Benjamin Levine and James Stray Gunderson in their 2006 review, really leaning heavily on these guys, and also the latest review I could find, Contemporary Periodization of Altitude Training in Elite Endurance Athletes from 2019. These papers have recommendations around volume and intensity, and they certainly did help me along with the additional monitoring to make those daily prescriptions. Starting on week one, the first 2 to 3 days are all about acclimatization. The volume you choose is related to the experience, with first-time athletes recommended to take a conservative approach, meaning reduction in the first 2 to 3 days of 25% from full sea level volume. It's interesting to note that an increased frequency from normal is recommended, so you can do a longer session split into 2 shorter sessions. But of course, this isn't so common in cycling. If you're a normal altitude experienced athlete, emerging data suggests elite athletes can tolerate high training volumes upon immediate ascent to altitude. The intensity in these first 2 to 3 days is recommended to be predominantly low intensity, aiming for blood lactate at or below lactate threshold. They are actually having a further recommendation that you can do shorter work, under 30 seconds with greater than 2 minutes rest. And this is surprising, as all recommendations outside of these reviews are for no max efforts at all. And this is going to come down to the individual athlete, but it's worth trying with an experienced athlete, as there's some evidence that muscle loss occurs at altitude, so doing some work to stop this would fall in this duration. When looking at what the teams do, all of the teams use the first 2 days as easy days, and it does seem the volume varies depending on previous experience, but I can't be 100% certain about that. Of course, I don't know every single rider. We have everything from 2 hours to 2.5 hours in the first 2 days to 4.5 to 5 hours in the first 2 days to 4.5 to 5 hours. I'm looking at you, Froom Dog. But they all ride under threshold from around 60 to 90% of FTP, except for Ineos. And they start with 5 hours, then 6, then 4 hours in the first 3 days. The thing to understand here is in this acclimatization period, the body is making some pretty big adjustments to the altitude. The initial signs of acclimatization include increasing breathing rate, aka overbreathing, and this is actually a good sign as it reflects a good sensitivity for the changed environment. And the second major area is increased urination. And this again is another clear symptom of being responsive to altitude. So running to the toilet frequently is normal and actually welcome, as is losing more fluids from increased ventilation as we breathe, water vapor is breathed out. And this means staying focused on hydration is important the whole camp, but especially in the first few days, where it's common practice to use sports drinks to add extra carbs to this extra hydration. Now, I've read recommendations for daily fluid intakes of 3 to 5 liters to maintain fluid balance, best in the form of isotonic carboelectrolyte drinks and juices. Others suggest fluid needs as high as 7 liters per day in cyclists during altitude training. The way that I'm going to stay on top of this hydration is from 2 daily weigh-ins, an initial nude weight before riding and a nude weight after returning from a ride. And the key here is to replace 1.2 to 1.5 times lost weight in fluid. We're aiming to hit at least 100% of loss in the first hour or so, and overcompensating slightly here because the athlete will be stimulated to urinate by the ingestion of the liquid. So you also have to account for that on top of the specific altitude variables. That's not the only thing to keep an eye on at the start of the camp, because the goal here is to monitor a couple of key metrics to watch them stabilize before you're good to increase the intensity and volume in training. Or so I thought. The first of these metrics is oxygen saturation, specifically sleep oxygen saturation. And this is really just checking it to monitor before getting up. I have read studies where researchers took readings from sleeping athletes between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. in the morning. That is super keen. Oxygen saturation is a simple thing to measure. It's just a matter of getting a clip-on monitor that goes onto your finger and gives you the reading. Typically, your oxygen saturation sits at around 98% at sea level, but it will drop at the start of the acclimatization process. And it will drop, what I've read, anywhere between 87 to 88% at those moderate range altitudes. From this lower level, you should expect a daily increase in saturation where it goes up and it stabilizes. It will never reach the 98% saturation of sea level, and I was expecting anywhere between 93, 94, 96%. What I noticed in reality was the drop wasn't as great as I was expecting, and getting down to only 95% on the first day, then back up to 96 on the second day. And it kind of oscillated between these numbers over the next days before finally leveling out on days 14 to 19 at 97%. So it seems that this measure is also sensitive to training in the first few days. And if you do some intensive training before it stabilizes, it will go up and down. But in my mind, it didn't necessarily impact the benefit of the training if it did dip, say, 1% down, because it would come back up the next day and then it was still making its way back up to that stabilization period. The next two things to monitor are HRV and resting heart rate, and these should also stabilize during the acclimatization period. They didn't in this case. So this was good between my research and the practical findings that I found, is that in this camp, both HRV and resting heart rate show the impact of altitude across the first 9 days, and especially as the hardest 3-day block was from days 7 to 9, it was still impacting these numbers. HRV dropped over consecutive days to a camp low on day 9, while resting heart rate was increasing by 15 beats over the first 9 days before a rest day. Then it leveled out and slightly reduced to lower than pre-altitude levels. So this took actually longer than expected. Finally, it's ideal to test hemoglobin mass every 7 days to monitor changes. And if you're not seeing any increase, then you might need to change the elevation you're sleeping at. We didn't get into this, but lucky that the elevation that we chose worked out. The other habit to get into is daily wellness monitoring. For me, this comes in the form of a questionnaire that I put together. As I was monitoring this camp remotely, I wanted as much information as possible. And the form included a weigh-in, and it included that saturation number. We were, of course, getting HRV resting heart rate separately because we monitor that normally. And then the form itself had 2 scientifically validated questionnaires that have been shown to identify signs of overtraining and altitude sickness, 2 very important parts of this. And these are the Lake Louise acute mountain sickness and the daily analysis of life demands of an athlete. And I also added another one that hasn't got as much proof, but it's not so many questions. It's the profile of mood states. And so that was easy to kind of tack on the end. Add this to the training data and to messenger chats, and that's your daily monitoring. From this, all decisions about the next day's training were made. And I was looking for things like not hitting the numbers with no reasonable explanation and negative trends in the answers on the form, especially across multiple days. As a general rule, training load, volume, and or intensity can be reduced when 2 or more of the above-mentioned answers were outside of the normal range of the athlete. There are some papers, one called Monitoring Adaption During Altitude Training, with really specific numbers for monitoring metrics, but this was a step too far for the first training camp, and I could see how this is useful when running a camp for more athletes, but it really wasn't needed in this situation. Okay, let's get to the last 4 days of the first week. If things are leveling out and you're feeling good, it's generally time to step up the volume and intensity. And we actually concluded that we can go longer earlier in the next camp because the sensations of feeling on top of the altitude were there from day two, day three. So we could have gone earlier, but we decided to do 3 days of acclimatizing, building the volume each day, then have a rest day to reset, and then go into 2 hard days. As for the training, it's most common here to see the first sets of overload training days, so these 2 days together or 3 days of combined training after the acclimatization period and a recovery day. But once it steps up, we're talking about sessions at team camps that include efforts like 4 times 15 minutes at 88 to 92% of FTP at 900 to 1800 meters, 1.5 hours at 60% with random sprints up to 600 watts at less than 1000 meters, 30 minutes at 80%, 18 minutes at 70%, 30 minutes at 80% at 900 to 1400 meters. Now, I'm not sure if you picked up on the altitude that these efforts were done, but this is an important detail. While I said it's common not to do max efforts in the acclimatization period, it's actually not recommended ever to do them at altitude. And this doesn't mean that you cannot add them into the camp, though. I'll get into the details on that in a moment. But first, the recommendations for volume and intensity are to increase from day 4. And the teams follow this and lift the intensity with a lot of time spent at intense endurance levels. The recommendation for the rest of the training is to use the altitude training camp to generally complete threshold or VO2 max workouts at a reduced intensity, reduced volume, and increased recovery. The key recommendation is, when possible, it may be advantageous to do higher intensity training at lower altitudes for live high, train low. How low? Under 1,000 meters is where the hard efforts are done. I've read that 1,250 meters could be the cutoff, but as cyclists can move around easily and train anywhere, that's anywhere that there is a road, we stayed under 1,000 meters for the VO2 max efforts that we did. So let's take a look at how the teams did efforts and how they matched them to altitude in the training. And the first session I have here is this 1.5 hours at 60% with random sprints up to 600 watts. And it was done at under 1,000 meters. Then it's the 30 minutes at 90%. They have 8 times 20-second sprints every 3 minutes. And this was done between 300 and 900 meters. And the next session doesn't go over FTP. It's 4 times 15 minutes at sweet spot, 88 to 92% of FTP. And it's done between 900 and 1800 meters. And that is something you do see. As the camp progresses, the intensive endurance efforts do creep up to that 2000 meters. And this here is the most compelling training for races that hit these types of mountains. This is where you'll be sitting in the race, this type of intensity, as an acclimatized sweet spot effort is going to be more of an FTP effort by the time the altitude rolls around. And speaking of adjusted power targets, riding up and down all day and paying close attention to where you are in terms of altitude and adjusting power targets accordingly is really important. So what are the recommendations here? There is a generally accepted rule that anything under 1,000 meters, you'll find to use your sea level FTP to set all training zones. Between 1,000 meters and 1,600 meters, you take 20 watts off FTP. And anything above 1,600 meters, you take off 30 watts. In percentage terms, 1,000 to 1,600 meters is a 6.8 reduction for non-acclimatized, 4.4% reduction for acclimatized athletes. And at 1,600 to 2,000, it's 11.1% reduction for non-acclimatized and 6.9% for acclimatized. So you can see a bit of the work here as well is making sure that the athletes understand their power targets at the set altitudes. Moving on to the second and final week, where we start to see more intensity and volume. For example, Alpes and Phoenix, day 9, they have a HIIT workout, 4 hours, nearly 3,000 meters of climbing, and they do 4 times 5.5 minutes. This 5.5 minutes is made up of 30 seconds at 120% and then 30 seconds at 110%. Then they have 3.5 minutes at 75%. They do this 4 times. They do it between 900 and 1,000 meters. The next day, it's a 5 hour ride, 3,500 meters of climbing, and they do 3 times, 13 times 30 seconds at 115% and then 2 minutes at 88%. And they do this also pretty low, between 450 meters and 1,100 meters. Jumbo Visma, day 8, they're doing some medium level work, which is on a ride that's 3 hours long, nearly 5,000 meters of climbing, but they do 15 minutes at 85% and then 20 minutes at 88%. And this is between 800 and 1,500 meters. And then they do an hour and 10 minutes at 75% of FTP between 1,600 meters and 2,500 meters. And this type of trend just continues. We see the longer efforts at Bahrain Merida, where 20 minutes at 90% done between 1,300 meters and 1,800 meters. And then there's 40 minutes at 70% between 1,500 meters and 2,100 meters. So the general trend here is that teams will wait until day 9 to 12 before adding a high-intensity training day, which is a bit earlier than recommended if you're doing some of the harder work at higher altitudes. If you remember, it's around 14 days when full acclimatization is more likely to occur. But I would say that all of the athletes here are experienced enough to know whether to start working harder or not. And here's an example of the higher intensity sessions done later again in the camp. It's Alpes and Phoenix on day 14, do a 4 hour ride, 2,500 meters of climbing, and they do 5 times those 5.5 minute efforts, the 30 seconds at 120%, 30 seconds at 110% with a rest. And they do that all the way up to 1,800 meters. So they're really starting to push the boundaries here. Jumbo Visma do a similar thing where they start adding 5 times 10 second sprints every 6 minutes between 1,200 and 1,900 meters. And then they do this all the way up to 2,000 meters where they're adding sprints to 100% of FTP for 24 minutes and then again for 18 minutes and they're sprinting every 10 seconds and they go all the way up to 2,000 meters. Overall though, you will notice when looking at the trends here that when the intensity goes up, the altitude stays quite low. It does creep up a little compared to earlier on in the camp, but no one's doing any sprints over say 2,000 meters. Even when Jumbo Visma was going up to 3,000 meters, they were just keeping it nice and easy. So let's just move here to my final couple of observations. And I have included the total elevation gain in these rides, which is very easy to rack up when climbing in these mountainous regions. And big elevation gains also match race-like conditions. And all the rides are similar in duration to big Grand Tour stages. And specifically, say this is a pre-tour camp, we can pick stage 9 of this year's Tour de France, the distance 191 kilometers, elevation gain 4,300 meters, and the peak elevation 2,400 meters. And this type of ride is pretty common when you start looking at distance and elevation gains across all of the rides at these training camps. The final thing to note here that was just flat out interesting to me, while we don't have any data from Ineos, I can report that Richie Porte, without fail, did an hour of low intensity, probably fat max work, on the trainer every single morning before doing his prescribed rides. So he'd do an hour ride and then jump on the bike and then do rides like 170 Ks, 4,300 meters of climbing over nearly 7 hours. Or he'd do an hour, then he'd go out for 150 Ks, 4,000 meters of climbing over nearly 6 hours. The dude is a machine.
You don't have to do this. You don't want to do this.
Desire is irrelevant. I am a machine.
I thought I'd wrap up here with some final thoughts on the process and whether it was worth it. Hopefully now you have an appreciation of how many things need to come together to have a chance of being a responder. And we didn't talk about responders versus non-responders here, but there is an argument that non-responders just didn't get some part of the whole process right. And I can understand this logic because it really is a lot of work for just one athlete, let alone a larger group. Things like the pre-altitude blood tests and iron supplementation to monitoring the athlete's response to the right altitude. And then there's things like planning the routes so you can hit the right work at the right elevation with the right adjusted FTP and get the right elevation gain from the entire ride. I have come away from the experience with a better understanding of what it takes to get this work done. And the next time I see someone crash out of a grand tour in the first few stages, I will probably cry. But seriously, we are seeing excellent increases in blood measures immediately after the camp we've done, and also a few weeks after the camp, they're even better than those ones we took straight after. Performance is also good, but that's still to be tested where it really counts. For now, I would do it again with this athlete. They were able to hit good numbers regardless of the altitude, and I don't feel like it compromised training at all, and the terrain certainly was a bonus to get in some extra climbing. So if you're planning one, I hope this helps, and I hope it gives you an insight in what it takes to compete at the top level. I'm going to add the athlete info sheet I've put together in the Cycling Science Digest Hub. To get it, all you have to do is sign up free for a 7-day trial and download it, and also check out the first 6 issues of the Cycling Science Digest, the only cycling-specific publication that is reviewing the latest in cycling science every month. Details and a link to purchase are in the show notes. And with that, Ride Better, Faster is written, hosted, and scored by me, Damien Roos. Until next time, ride well.